I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the changing landscape for educators. Few places in American life are under more pressure to adapt than our schools. We're going to talk about how people in the profession of teaching are adjusting. My guests are Dr. Milton Chen, author of the bestseller Education Nation and the former director of the George Lucas Education Foundation, and Dr. Chantel Landry, newly named president of the American College of Education. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today on No Limits about the changing landscape for educators. The locally based American College of Education graduates its 2017 class of teachers this Saturday, so that's kind of the springboard for our conversation. If you want to join this discussion, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Milton Chen. He is the author of the bestseller Education Nation and the former director of the George Lucas Education Foundation. He's joining us by Skype, and joining us by phone is Dr. Chantel Landry, who is the newly named president of the American College of Education. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, John.
Certainly. It's good to have both of you with us. So I'm gonna start, I said at the top of the show that I can't think of too many places in American life right now that are under more pressure right at this moment than America's schools and the people who work in them. Could we talk really about kind of the scope of those changes, the changes in expectations, the changes really in responsibilities and in the way we approach education? I'm going to start with you on that one, Dr. Chen.
Well, I think that it's a good thing that the public is paying more attention to public education. The world has changed dramatically just in the past decade and certainly in the past two decades. So here we are in 2017, trying to modernize our public schools, and that includes our universities as well. Mm-hmm. It holds the key to the future of America and the future of the world. I think it's a good thing that more voices are weighing in, parents in particular paying closer attention to the quality of schools, and my hope is that that will result in a more modern school system that educates all children. I think that's an important point, all children, to higher levels.
Dr. Landry, what are some of the changes that you see, the ones that are having the most impact on the profession?
Well, at American College of Education, given that most of our curriculum at this point is focused on educators, especially at the K-12 level, it is something near and dear to our hearts. We're really about providing affordable education that has an impact on their classrooms and their students. We've worked really hard to make this not super theoretical so that they get they do get the theory that they need in their master's degrees in education, but it's really about applicability and what are they doing that changes the students and changes the classrooms that they're involved in. We feel very strongly about.
We've gotten an email question from a listener, and if you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what our regular listener Jerry has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, should the right to school choice include public funding for parents and students to choose schools which specifically cater to their own personal opinions about sex, religion, and or politics? Dr. Landry, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, that's a very loaded question.
Yeah, well.
You know, public funding, in my opinion, really needs to go to public schools. I think there are other models and things that we can use in terms of school choice, because I think all students deserve high quality, top-notch education. But it really means rethinking some of our financial models that we use for public schools, making sure that students are not defined by their zip code. And at this point, many students are. Their zip code determines what type of funding their school gets. And that's the model we really need to focus on fixing.
Dr. Chen, are we having the right kind of discussion when we talk about school choice? And I should preface that question by saying we've done quite a few programs about education during this show's history. And one of the themes that has come through is that, you know, in the past generation or so, we have learned so much more about the way the brain processes information, about the way people learn and all of that. But those breakthroughs in that research don't seem to be finding their way into at least the political discussion of how we shape our education models. So are we having the right kinds of discussions about education? And if we aren't, what kind should we be having?
Well, I'm glad you raised that, John, because as you look across the education conversations we're having, there are places where the conversation is really trying to address the research that has come forward really in the past two decades about how children learn. In fact, you could say that we've known for a long time through some of the more progressive approaches to education, going back to John Dewey, that children need, as Dr. Landry was pointing out, to understand the relevance of what they're learning, how it applies to their own lives, how they can make use of what they're learning. There's been a separation, kind of an isolation between what's taught in the classroom and what children see in their own daily lives. So I do believe that the conversation is shifting, but as you point out, perhaps not enough in policy circles. We need to show more examples, and importantly, to have the research to support these innovations that I like to talk about, such as project-based learning, where children are doing projects in their own communities, applying math, science, history, language arts. It's a very much a shift from the textbook-based curriculum to a project-based curriculum. We're beginning to develop the research base for that, but perhaps not enough policymakers understand the power of these innovations, and including the use of technology.
So let's make you, dictator for a day here. and give you the opportunity to reshape both policy and the discussion that we have. How should we be framing it? I mean, what, you know, if we were really to reorganize our schools, and, you know, because we're reorganizing the schools, that means we're reorganizing the teaching profession, all of that. What should we be doing right now?
Well, I like to say that in this day and age, everyone should consider themselves both a teacher and a learner. And I think the most important, you know, traditionally we've had the roles, a teacher stands in front of the classroom and communicates the knowledge that she or she has, and the students take notes and try to absorb what's in the teacher's mind. But of course, the knowledge that exists today is on the internet, and teachers are more in the role of becoming a guide and a mentor and a coach. I think that some of the best examples of what learning should be come from the performing arts, the visual and performing arts, and from the world of sports, where it's all about performance, what you can do with the knowledge that you have. So if I were dictator for a day, I would have everyone involved in education, from the policy makers, from the governors on down through state legislators, federal officials, as well as parents, experience both what it is like to communicate what you know, everyone has something they can teach, but also to try to experience learning and how you would go about learning about a new topic, whether it's something in the formal curriculum or maybe just a hobby that you'd like to learn more about. I for instance, have taken up a new interest in jazz piano at the age of 64. And the new tools that are available, the apps, the internet, the online lessons. And I'm also, I have a wonderful teacher who's in his 30s. I'm old enough to be his father. So it changes the who's a teacher, who's a learner, and I agree that every adult involved in education should also be in the process of learning, and I'm sure that's what American College of Education is all about, communicating professional development and the courses and the skills that educators need to have today.
Dr. Landry, I'm going to give you the same opportunity to be dictator for a day here. I know already you want to break down the model that determines educational opportunity by zip code. What other ways would you change things?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Dr. Chen. When you really think about both a learner and a teacher at the same time, it changes things. And for the segment that of the population we're talking about today, these students are used to online learning. They're used to hands-on learning. They're used to interaction. So expecting our schools to still function as they were set up in the 1930s and 1940s is not going to reach the students that are coming to us today. It really is about being that guide and mentor and coach and having them actively engage in their learning. But it takes some rethinking because it means we are not focused on textbooks. We should be teaching students how to consume knowledge because the knowledge is available now. Rather than we teach the knowledge, mm-hmm. we need to be teaching how to consume it. What do you do with it? How do you determine fake news and not fake news? How do you determine real journalism? What do you do with research? What does it mean for your decision making? So really a shift in the way we're educating our teachers so that we're teaching them how to do that. While they need a strong content background, they really need that pedagogy that helps them understand how do I reach learners, how do I teach learners, and how do I get them to actively engage with me. So I think putting that all together and really reshaping how do we educate teachers in the first place so that they understand their role as a mentor and a guide and a coach, that's going to translate into the classroom because the students who are coming to us are expecting something different than what we grew up with. And our educators need to be able to handle that.
How difficult, and Dr. Landry, I'm going to stay with you on this one, the work of preparing teachers has to have changed dramatically in the past 30 years or so, ever since the publication of A Nation at Risk sort of kicked the education wars into high gear in this country. What are some of the biggest changes confronting the profession right now?
Well, in many cases, what we see a lot of the national associations and a lot of the teacher accreditation associations focusing on is very early experiences for the profession. So not waiting until students are in year four of an undergraduate degree to put them in a classroom, because many of them at that point, while it worked for so many of us, if we don't prepare them early so that they have an understanding of really what they're getting into, so much when teachers will tell you this, when you're in the classroom, you're a parent, you're a mentor, you're a coach, you're a guide, you're a friend, you're so many things to those students, and we need to make sure those are the types of things we are doing. And we're starting to see some change in teacher prep so that we are putting teachers in or potential teachers in classrooms much, much earlier with students, giving them a chance to test out theory, giving them a chance to really interact and get to understand things I think we probably need to do. And I don't see a lot of schools of ed actually doing this yet, is starting to address this online education question. I mean, we've thought about it at the higher ed level, but we're seeing more and more K-12 situations pop up with virtual education, virtual high schools. I've seen some virtual elementaries at this point. And that does change teacher prep significantly. And I don't know that we're there yet in the country where we've really focused on making sure our teachers can function in any environment. How do they handle a classroom full of kids, and how do they handle a virtual classroom? It's different, and I don't know that we're there yet in terms of your whole dictator for a day. Mm-hmm. I'd want us to really do some rework on that end to make sure we prepare students for either experience, because when students are graduating, they don't necessarily know which one they want or need or where they're going to end up, and we need to make sure they're prepared for either one.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the changing landscape for educators. The locally based American College of Education is going to be graduating its 2017 class of teachers this Saturday. That's the springboard for our conversation. If you want to join the discussion, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can check us out on social media. My guests are Dr. Milton Chen, author of Education Nation, and Dr. Chantel Landry, president of the American College of Education. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the changing landscape for educators. The locally based American College of Education is going to be graduating its 2017 class of teachers this Saturday. My guests are Dr. Milton Chen, who's author of the bestseller Education Nation. He's going to be speaking to the class. And Dr. Chantel Landry, who is the newly named president of the American College of Education. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Jim has done and give us a send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jim writes, the coming climate crisis is being all but ignored by our educational system, and it is a profound and dangerous disservice to our kids. Our system should be re-envisioned toward full-scale, panoramic, and humane sustainability education. Our schools should be net zero emitters of carbon. They should be farms. They should be centers for systems thinking and climate solutions. Put kids in leadership positions to restore our connection to nature and to civics. And in the process, they will learn everything a traditional system teaches while enhancing the opportunity to anticipate the crisis with confidence and resiliency. Dr. Chen, I'm going to let you respond to that one first.
Well, there's a lot in that comment that I would agree with. I've been an advocate for more environmental education in schools. I chair an advisory committee for the National Park Service, which should also be thought of as we think more expansively about the shift that's needed for public schools, can also be thought of as an important partner for public school systems. There are a number of state and federal agencies that are providing educational experiences for students that have online curricula. If listeners want to know more about what the national parks are doing, the website would be NPS, nationalparkservice.gov/teachers. It was the centennial of the national parks last year. A lot more families and more diverse families coming into the national parks and teachers taking advantage of the programs as well. So to the listener's question, I do believe that I like to talk about the whole child. I like to talk about how the child lives in their community, experiences weather, experiences issues related to the environment, and that's a good place to start. In fact, the National Park Service has a whole climate education initiative. I work here in the Golden Gate National Parks in the Bay Area, and we have had conferences with educators and K-12 teachers about how to present climate issues in the classroom.
Dr. Landry, and I'm going to pick up on that a little bit. I mean, it seems to me the subtext to Jim's question and to a lot of this discussion is this idea that we somehow look at schools as separate from the community or the culture or the social structure when, you know, there are really few things that are more central to community than the school systems. Is some of the solution or the way to better address our education challenges to integrate schools more fully into the community?
Yes, because schools really do need to be part of the community. A lot of what we can be doing in schools in terms of project-based learning has to do with issues that are connecting them. It's a way to engage learners. It's a way to get them to understand that learning is real world and it's not textbook, when what they're doing is truly engaging in real problems and a traditional textbook skills, if you will, as a result of working on those problems. So when we really shift the way we teach and the way we think about how to impart knowledge, schools would be part of that, because they wouldn't be separate. That truly is the ideal. And I love the ideas of bringing the national parks into it. I am sure there are many social studies teachers and history teachers and science teachers that would love to do that, because it's no problems. They're not just hearing about something in a textbook.
Gotten another email from a listener, and I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation here. I think it's Shannon. Writes, I totally agree. I currently am a coach, and I feel like hands-on learning and utilizing technology have elevated my students' ability to learn from me. I use YouTubes and video to show them what they are doing versus what I would like for them to do, and they learn so much faster through the visual combined with hands-on project approach. Dr. Chen, I'm presuming that there's research that supports that.
Well, the use of video I find to be a very exciting development in education. Educational video, part of my background involves starting my career many years ago at Sesame Workshop in New York, and I was in the research and curriculum department through Sesame Street and another reading series called The Electric Company. These were shows broadcast by PBS starting in the late 60s through the 1970s and 80s. One of the lessons I learned early on in my career is that children can learn more than we think, and they can learn it more quickly than we think, if we give them the right experiences, the right media, the right tools, the right coaching and mentoring. Sesame Street, I think often people forget, was a program for preschool children to learn to count from 1 to 10, letters, numbers, even some social skills, some cognitive skills like classification. And many educators in the K-1 grade said, well, that'll never work. We're having trouble teaching them that in kindergarten and first grade. How can you teach that to a three-year-old? So I like the fact that, as this listener points out, students can now learn things more quickly and more easily. The visual becomes very important, and hopefully do it more, dare I say it, joyfully, in a more engaged way. I do believe that learning should be enjoyable. And often, as we're saying, students find engagement and joy and fun in their learning when they have more flexibility, can learn in different ways.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Rylan via Twitter. Again, you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. Rylan writes, when students who have disabilities use vouchers to attend private schools, why are the private schools not required to follow IDEA? Dr. Landry, I'll throw that one your way.
That's a great question. It's not one I'm as familiar with, given that it's been a while since I've been in K-12, and a lot of that is set at the state level rather than the federal level. So it's not something I'm as familiar with in terms of what's required for IDEA.
Well, and I think probably we ought to talk. Indiana is kind of a special place. We have in some ways the most expansive school voucher plan in the country, and are committed to really that idea of I would say the older model of school choice. Has that been that this discussion about school choice and about vouchers in particular been helpful in helping us confront education's challenges, or has it been harmful? I'll start with you, Dr. Chen.
Well, I think the term school choice and vouchers very quickly becomes a political issue.
Yes.
About where the money's flowing, who's operating schools, this question about if you open up private schools and receive public funding, well, what are the standards and what is the quality of those private schools, especially for students with disabilities? So I would like to see generally public education, public schools improve. And I think we can point around the country to a number of not just individual schools, but school districts where that's going on. It is possible to offer a high quality public school education to all students, students with disabilities, students who come from low income backgrounds. So when there are 14,000 school districts, we want to see more of them doing that. But I hope that more districts will learn from other districts about how to provide the kind of services that this listener is asking about.
Dr. Landry, I'd like to hear your thoughts too.
Well, I do agree. It becomes very much a political issue. However, I think the discussion is important because if you, in effect, it comes back to competition,
mm-hmm.
right? So when you think about businesses and the world we live in and competition, it tends to make lots of people better. And I think the same thing can happen with schools. If there is no competition, so let's say there is no private system and all there is the public system, maybe public's not going to be as strong as it needs to be, but having the private system and then having the discussion about vouchers and school choice really does raise the bar in many cases. And it makes sure the public at large knows that it's not okay to have failing public schools, that all students have the right to a high quality education. And we're capable of providing it. We need to do some rethinking. We need to think about what the curriculum looks like and how to really engage the community and students. But every student deserves it, and we're capable of providing it. So I do think the discussion is important.
Dr. Landry, how many future teachers are you going to be graduating this Saturday?
Well, we have 2,200 graduates that are finishing up this year. In addition, at commencement itself, mm-hmm. we're going to have a number of students that are walking, and we're going to have a number of students that are going to attend virtually, which is going to be interesting. They're bringing over 1,000 guests, so we'll have a great Saturday. But when you're graduating about 2,200 graduates a year, all at the master's level, and you think about just one teacher impacting just, let's say, a class of 30, that impact is pretty tremendous.
How do they feel entering the profession right now? Because one of the comments I hear often from career teachers is that this discussion and the political debates about education that we've been referring to during this conversation often just leave them feeling, you know, at the very best, unappreciated, and at the very worst, absolutely battered. You know, and I know that enrollment in a lot of education programs at colleges and universities, at least here in Indiana, has declined. We've seen stories about teacher shortages in places. What is the mindset of this class going into the profession?
I would say the mindset is probably not as encouraging as it has been in the past. It's one of the things we've really focused on in our graduate programs is this sense of elevating the profession, bringing the status back to the profession. Now, of course, we're doing it a little at a time because we're doing it with our graduating classes. But what we try and do with the students that are entering is really talk about the power they have to change things both for their students and their school systems, and really get them back to that thinking of it's an elevation. This is a very noble profession to enter, and I don't think they're necessarily entering it all the time with the idea that it's noble anymore. We see more discouragement when we're talking to students, especially when we're doing focus groups in that 0 to 5 year range. Much more discouragement probably than we've seen in the past. So we've focused a lot on how do we bring back that renewed sense that what they're doing matters and that they're impacting lives, and that's what's most important.
Dr. Chen, you're going to be the commencement speaker. What are you going to tell them?
Well, I hope to inspire them and elevate the profession, to tell them how important, as Dr. Landry is saying, how important their work is. We as a nation need to do much more, and it wouldn't cost any more money. It wouldn't require any more change in policy, but much more to talk about the role of the teacher. The changed role of the teacher, perhaps, but the impact of teachers. I like to say that everything important comes down to education. All the news that we're talking about these days about the global economy, we mentioned climate change, jobs, the workforce, healthcare, all that really comes down to education. The ability of citizens, patients, students to learn more. If patients took better care of themselves earlier, the cost of health care would be much lower. So I hope to communicate that all these important issues of the day come down to education and therefore the role of the teacher. And I'll also be talking about the importance suggested by earlier comments, the importance of taking a view of the whole child, that children come to their learning with all of their senses, with all of their curiosity, and we need to build on that. I like to say that children need to come to their senses in their learning, to use all of their senses, their visual, the sense of touch, sense of taste. We didn't talk much about, but I do think that food is a great way to organize learning, just to have children learn about how does the food get to your table? What are you eating and how did it get there? There's a lot of chemistry, economics, process involved in that, but there are basic things that are not part of our curriculum that children experience every day and have questions about.
Gotten a question via Facebook from a listener named Gary. And again, if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Gary writes, question, could someone explain the teaching English as a foreign language, how much it costs and how long it takes? I'm considering teaching in China. And then thanks you for any insights that you might have. Either one of you, Dr. Landry, Dr. Chen, have any expertise there?
Is he asking about teaching English in China?
Yeah, teaching English as a foreign language in China.
That is not an area where I have expertise. However, if he came in via Facebook, I'd almost recommend he puts that question to American College of Education Facebook group, because we have a number of students that come from China. So even at this year's commencement, we have students coming from Japan, Vietnam, West Indies, and China. But especially China, we have a number of students there that are U.S. citizens that teach English as a second language over there. So he might get some answers from some students that are already doing that.
So the best way for him to do this would be to go to, is it just American College of Education on Facebook, or do you go with an acronym like ACE or something like that?
Yeah, so if he just searches American College of Education, it'll come up. And if he just poses the question at large, we tend to get a lot of answers from our alumni that are on our page and tend to answer questions for new potential students. So I would think he's going to get some answers there. He'll get some answers from students who are actually doing that in China now.
Okay. And I'm just glad that he's interested in doing that. I'm a Chinese-American by... Mm-hmm. And my parents came from China. I'm trying to do more in the last decade of my career to foster more U.S.-China educational exchange. I think he'll quickly find out that there's a huge demand for learning English in China, in public schools as well as independent schools there. And they're very hungry to have American teachers come over and teach English. So I encourage that. And I think the more the teachers hear, I have an international experience that will very much help with this idea of trying to bring in global learning into the classroom. Now, we have all sorts
Dr.
of ways
Chen,
of doing that
I'm
through technology,
have to
but
cut in
yes, I'm glad he's interested.
Going to have to take a break. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the changing education, changing landscape for educators. Boy, I can't talk. That is an obstacle in this business. As this weekend, the locally based American College of Education is going to be graduating its 2017 class of teachers. My guests are Dr. Milton Chen. He is the author of the bestseller Education Nation, and is also the former director of the George Lucas Education Foundation, and Dr. Chantel Landry, who is the newly named president of the American College of Education. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Josh has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Just fine. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to maybe challenge an assertion that Dr. Landry made earlier about competition helping in the public education realm. That's something that I used to kind of be on board with, but the more reading I've done, and I can't recall exactly what specifically I read, had led me to think, though, that a market-based approach like we have here in the U.S. towards education seems to be doing, I guess, more harm than good necessarily. And it kind of goes along also with the other assertion that she made about failing public schools. I think it's something I've always kind of had a hard time wrestling with, is labeling a school as failing when I know that the primary factors that make up a school are students, of course. And so in some ways it feels like when you say a failing school, it's more like code for children themselves who aren't necessarily able to succeed, not necessarily the school itself. So I don't have anything specific to go off with that, but that's just something that's been kind of in the back of my mind for the last several years, though. Those two things, the competition aspect and then the failing school aspect.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Josh. Dr. Landry, I'm going to give you a chance to respond.
So is your question really about the notion of competition? Can you tell me exactly what you're...
Well, he's not with us any longer. Normally we clear the call and clear the phone line as soon as the question gets asked. But his question, at least as I heard it, was, is competition actually helping the schools? And Josh, I hope I'm doing justice to this. At least what I heard is that creates a culture of winners and losers, which means that some kids will be left behind.
Well, that's interesting because I personally don't see it that way. I don't think it creates competition. I mean, I don't think it creates winners and losers. I think what it does is get everyone to step up their game in all aspects. And in terms of the failing schools, I don't think we're saying the school is failing and all the kids are failing, but definitely schools are not performing as well as others. And if they don't, I think it's a job to go in and figure out why, give them the tools and resources they need to get better so that students are not stuck in a school that is continuing not to do well. There are always going to be some schools that are going to do better than others. Our jobs are to bring everyone up.
We've gotten another question from a listener named Sharon, who didn't want to go on the air. It says, what sort of gaps or differences do your guests see between teaching in urban school communities and rural school communities? Can something as seemingly simple as broadband access have a significant impact, or is it more about teachers' relationships with their students? Dr. Chen, I'll go with you first on that one.
I think that's a good example of not either or, but both and. We need to make sure that students everywhere, whether they're in urban schools or rural schools, have access to the modern tools of technology. And there are students both in urban areas and in rural areas who do not. There are pockets of Los Angeles, for instance, that do not have access to broadband internet. So I think this is a case where we need to redouble our efforts, the role of policy, primarily federal, but also state policy, and incentives for telecommunications companies together with communities to provide that including devices. We have a good example of that in California called the California Emerging Technology Fund, where as a state we did, as a condition of mergers of telecommunications companies, have them put aside some funding to make sure that those who did not have access in both urban and rural areas of California had access, training for parents, training for teachers, providing devices. So we'd like to see more of that happening nationally. And also that, you know, generally, we now live in an age where students anywhere, anytime can be learning. So hopefully we'll see more students from different backgrounds achieve success and learn at higher levels.
Gotten an email from a listener named Patrice. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Patrice writes, in Indiana, private schools are now allowed to pick and choose their students, leaving the disabled and those with learning disabilities in the public school creates more difficulty for the public schools who are also losing funding, creates an unfair environment to raise the bar. Dr. Chen, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And really, you know, the other way it seems to me to take some of the sting out of the education debate is right now, at least fairly or unfairly, the perception is that the pie stays the same size and one sector or other of the education community gets a bigger slice or a smaller slice. Is some of the solution increasing the size of the pie so that people don't feel like their slices are being diminished? But again, let me throw that one first to you, Dr. Chen.
Generally, I would like to see much greater investment in public investment in schools. At the same time that we do see public school districts who have roughly the average amount of per pupil spending doing quite well. Mm-hmm. So it's both about making better use of the resources that exist, but also, as this question indicates, making sure that students with special needs who require more attention, require more support, also receive that. So I'm glad we're spending some time in this conversation about special education, and it's you know, as we're discovering, many students are needing this additional support and are often left behind. So I'm glad to hear that, you know, that there's interest in this and we need to give more attention to it and at the same time understand how technology, assistive technology, is enabling students to learn again far beyond what their disabilities might have suggested even 10 or 20 years ago.
We are talking about the changing landscape for educators here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Marianne has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Marianne, you're on the air.
Thank you. The conversation is delightful thus far, and I'm eager to read Dr. Chen's book. We have not had always the best experience with for-profit higher education in Indiana. I wasn't familiar with ACE. I've never heard of them before. So I looked quickly, and I'm seeing that they actually – I guess I have some questions for you. I'm seeing that you are headquartered – or your offices are in Indiana, but you're actually an Illinois for-profit corporation, and your directors are all in Texas and Massachusetts, I think. I'm curious as to how you – it looks like you were originally in Texas – and that Dr. Rod Page, former Secretary of Education, maybe has been a director for a long time, maybe not. Could you maybe give us some more information about your history? Who does own you? And are you planning to put any Indiana directors on the board? And then also, you appear to be located in the same building downtown that a number of the strong pro-voucher, pro-private school vouchers organizations are located in. And I'm wondering whether you have any relationships or day-to-day workings or planning or anything with any of the Institute for Quality Education or Network for Quality Education or Hoosiers for Quality Education or the Friedman Foundation or EdChoice. Or are you just a wonderful college?
Thanks very much. Yeah, there are about six or seven questions there, but I'll give Dr. Landry a chance to answer as many of them as possible. Thanks for the call, Marianne.
You're welcome.
Certainly. Dr. Landry?
Sure, I'd be happy to answer those questions. So when the college originally got started, we were started originally in the Chicago area, so in Illinois. And at some point, we made the decision in late 2011, and then we moved the college in 2012 to Indiana. And we moved it specifically because as an online college, Illinois was putting some requirements in place that would have forced all teacher ed programs to have a percentage done face-to-face. Really difficult administrative rules that would have made it hard to deliver on our mission. And our mission is all about high quality and affordability. So our degrees, while we are a for-profit, our degrees all in at a master's level are under $8,000. We do not participate in Title IV funding. So everything is self-pay for students. They pay as they go so that they can graduate without debt. That is really because we are all about teacher ed, and a high price tag is not going to get a teacher necessarily what he or she needs. If you take on $30,000 or $40,000 to get a master's degree, you're never going to see that back in your salary. So we are very committed to high quality and low cost, which is we ended up leaving the state of Illinois, and we interviewed many states to figure out where did we want to move the college. We selected Indiana because they were very welcoming and very open to what we were trying to do. So when we moved to Indiana, we just so happened to end up in the same building with a lot of those players that you mentioned, but we don't have any relationships with them. It's just that's what was available downtown. We were looking for our space. In terms of our Board of Trustees, which is who you were referencing when you're talking about Rod Page and those four members right now that are on our Board of Trustees, that's just our Board of Trustees. That's not who owns the college. That's not who works at the college. We have about 45 to 50 employees that live in Indiana. And so we have people that some people office out of our downtown location in Indiana. Some people work from their home. But we have a number of employees that actually live in the state. We've made some strides to work with many of the nonprofits within the state. You know, we support teachers' treasurers and many of those organizations that give back to teachers. We're one of the only both certified B Corps, and we've changed our LLC to a benefit corporation. We're one of the only ones in Indiana that's done both. Mm-hmm. And it's really about this passion for our mission and what which is break that perceived link between high quality and high cost. We work really hard to demonstrate that you can get graduate education at a low cost, that it doesn't have to be both cost and high quality. So that gives you some background about who we are and why we do what we do. In terms of our Board of Trustees, we're actually trying to grow the board now. We have four members. Our board of our bylaws call for seven. So, yes, we are looking at putting some additional Board of Trustees members in the state of Indiana. What we try and do is just select people who are going to give us their knowledge and expertise and really help us. So to date, we had not focused on where those Board of Trustees are located. You know, we get them together quarterly for our meetings and everyone flies in to a location that works for them. We've done some of our meetings in Indiana. We've actually done some meetings in Massachusetts. We've done meetings in Dallas. So we really just work on what works for those individuals as much as we can. But we are very much an Indiana institution and believe in what we're doing there in the state and what we can give back to the state. I hope that answers many of your questions.
Sure. The only one is who owns the American College of Education sheet?
So we are a wholly owned subsidiary by Higher Ed Holdings, and Higher Ed Holdings is owned by a holding company in Texas. So that gives you some background in terms of who owns us.
Okay. We have got a question via Twitter, and you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. It's not so much a question as a comment. It says, we must stop diverting public dollars to religious schools, popular but illegal. Equality, civil rights for all communities and kids. Probably should note that the courts, at least here in Indiana, have indicated that that public funds, as long as they pass through parents' hands, can go to private schools and or religious schools. Is that a helpful trend, Dr. Chen?
Well, again, I believe in greater investment in public schools. Mm-hmm. And I think as one of the whole issues with school choice and vouchers is that there aren't enough schools, quality schools in the private sector to accommodate large numbers of families leaving the public schools. So often you see schools starting up and organized by different groups. Sometimes they're religious groups, as you're pointing out. But I think we've seen enough evidence that public schools can improve, that districts can improve. But we also need public schools and districts to change the way in which they're using their funds and what they're providing. And one last example I'll just give is it's the middle of July and schools are closed. Mm-hmm. We now have new evidence around summer learning loss. We have one of the longest summer vacations of any industrialized country. And often we end up reteaching in the fall what students knew in the spring. So students are falling behind during these 3 months in their reading and in their math. And we also need to address that as well.
So do you think the schools, systems, some of them here in Indiana and around the country that are working toward what they call the balance calendars are on the right track, Dr. Chen?
I don't know that term specifically, but I do see school districts trying to find ways to increase learning time, I'll put it that way, yeah. Either during the school year or into the summer, lengthening if they can. That immediately becomes a financial and economic issue. Mm-hmm. But I think that we can talk all we want about the 9-month calendar, but we need to do more to give all students and not just students whose parents can afford summer camp and trips and enrichment to make use of those 3 months for the learning of all students.
So in terms of the balance calendar means that they have shorter breaks and they're spaced out through the year. So instead of having three
yes.
months off, you'd have mm-hmm. 2 or 3 weeks at a time. We've only mm-hmm. got about 15 seconds. Does that make a little more sense to you?
Yes, I've seen some districts doing that, and I do agree that instead of a long summer vacation, that might well help with summer learning loss.
Well, I would like to thank both of you. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Milton Chen. He's the author of the bestseller Education Nation, and Dr. Chantel Landry, who's president of the American College of Education, going to be graduating a lot of future teachers this Saturday. Wish them the best. I would like to thank both Dr. Chen and Dr. Landry and all of our listeners for some great questions and a great conversation. Please come back on Thursday when we're going to talk about opioid-addicted mothers. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.